Well, good afternoon. My guest today is Michael Fauntroy. Michael Fauntroy is a specialist in urban policy and civil rights, and he is on the faculty of the George Mason School of Public Policy. He speaks widely around the country on issues about civil rights, black voting rights, and political power in the African American community. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here today. So your recent book, Republicans and the Black Vote, gives quite a bit of history of the African-American vote in this country and how it's changed from being largely loyal to the Republican Party to today being much more Democratic. Can you explain a little bit about the history, I guess starting back with Abraham Lincoln, the best-known Republican president who was a champion for black voting rights?
Well, the history does go all the way back to the founding of the party, which was a coalition of Northeastern Quaker-influenced liberals and moderates from across the northern tier of the United States who were looking for a different sort of party that was more friendly to business. And so, therefore, you see this coalition come together to form the Republican Party. And part of the basis on which the party was founded was the importance of ending slavery. The party really was based in part all about the abolition of slavery. So that was a big part of the party, party framework. And as a result, you end up in a circumstance in which African Americans look at the political parties, and they make a rational judgment as to which one of the parties is operating in their interest, and at that time it was the Republican Party.
And the Democratic Party was more seen as the racist party at that time. Yeah?
Well, there's no question that the Democratic Party of that era was the conservative party in American politics. It took an oppositional stance regarding the abolition of slavery, the ending of the advocacy of civil rights for African Americans, and so on. And the Democratic Party of that era was also dominated by the Southern agricultural class in the United States. So as a consequence, you have this part sort of ideological, part geographical, and part business and sort of moral-based dichotomy between the two parties. So yes, the Democrats of that era were in direct opposition to much of what was going on in terms of the abolitionist movement. And so, you come to the Civil War, you come to the period immediately following the Civil War, in which you go through the Reconstruction era, a period in which African Americans began to see some significant influence and power in American politics. You have the first 22 members of the House of Representatives were elected roughly during that era, all of which were elected as Republicans. And not a lot of people know that in the post-Reconstruction era, there were quite a few African Americans elected to Congress, and more importantly, elected to state legislatures throughout the South. For example, the South Carolina and Mississippi state legislatures were majority black at one point during the Reconstruction era. But that all fell by the wayside as a result of sort of economic terrorism and economic intimidation, among other things, now violence against African Americans who sought to exercise their political rights. And as the federal government began to retreat from some of its promises, led by the Republicans, obviously, you see things begin to turn in a different direction, which kicks off a nearly century-long evolution of the parties, where the Republican parties were, where the Republican Party came to be known as oppositional to African American rights, and the Democratic Party came to be known as a bit more attractive in that regard.
And in your book, you talk about how during the Nixon administration, there were some efforts to address discrimination and increase black participation in business and jobs and regain votes for the Republicans. So when did it shift to the Democratic Party, the allegiance of of African American voters, and what was the evolution of that?
Well, it was a long, slow process. You know, Reconstruction, you know, depending on the historian, dates roughly from 1865 to 1867. And toward the end of Reconstruction, as Republicans are beginning to retreat on some of their promises, you begin to see African Americans locked out of the political process. And so as you get to the 20th century, the start of the 20th century, all but one of those African Americans who were elected to the House during Reconstruction or elected during the post-Reconstruction era were still in Congress, and that was George White, a representative from North Carolina, and he departed Congress in 1901. And so from that period, you began to see a number of things that contributed to a shifting of African Americans from the African American allegiance from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party, and there are a full range of things, including but not limited to the great migration of African Americans from southern agricultural routes to northern industrial cities. All up and down the South, you saw a movement of African Americans, say from North and South Carolina to places like Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, on up the East Coast. And then you saw a movement of African Americans, say from Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, northward up toward Memphis and Cleveland, Cincinnati, Chicago, Milwaukee, and so on. And so that movement put Democratic voters and Democratic leaders in the North in a tough position, because they now had all these new voters coming to their jurisdictions, and they could either take the position that the Southern Democratic Party took, which was to say, these people are to be forbidden from the process, or they could try to embrace and convert those voters. And in many cases, that's what happened. And so you have this great migration. You have World War II, where we're at toward the end of during the Truman administration, you have the desegregation of the armed forces. In the early 1950s, you have the outcry of Southern Democrats who are outraged at this movement towards civil rights, and they split from the party and formed the Dixiecrat Party. Well, that movement sent a signal to black voters around the country that that Southern Democrats were there, that there was a split in the Democratic Party with regard to the allegiance of African American voters. And then on and on and on, and as you get to the civil rights era, civil rights movement, the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, you began to see more Democrats getting on board, and you began to see more Republicans switching party allegiance, and many of the most conservative members of Congress during that era, beginning in the 1960s, began to switch and become Republicans. You know, Strom Thurmond, Jesse Helms are two prominent examples in that regard. Trent Lott at one point was a Democrat, former senator from Mississippi, and became a Republican, and just on and on. So yes, there's a long, tortured history of events and mileposts and things that led to this movement from the Republicans to the Democrats.
You talk about black voters being locked out. Fast forward many years to 2000, the most obvious example of that was the Florida election. And it was later found that 50,000 to possibly as many as 100,000 black voters were denied the right to vote, some because of previous felony convictions in other states, some because of mistakes in their names, just a huge purging of black voters, and most of them, it is assumed, would have been voting for the Democratic presidential nominee. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I really do think that's an under-discussed scandal in American politics, to my way of thinking. You know, these laws that disenfranchise felons at one level or another were put in place during the post-Reconstruction era to keep African Americans out of the political process, because there were just so many black voters in that era, particularly in the South, that if they were allowed to vote, then they would have much more impact on elections. And so they were ways were created to try to lock them out of the process and keep them from voting. And those laws have stayed on the books in many states around the country, although some states like Virginia, for example, are beginning to accelerate the process of reinstating voting rights to felons who've completed their sentences, for example. But the impact of this issue is absolutely incredible. And by the way, we don't know the full impact of it because we don't know, it's difficult to imagine how many state and local level races have been affected by this issue. But, about 13% of African American men are disenfranchised around the country. And in some states, that has a tremendous impact. For example, in Florida, there are nearly 830,000 African Americans who were disenfranchised. Ex-felons who were disenfranchised around the time of the 2000 election. And if you just sort of run the numbers by race, even if you use a much lower voter turnout standard, for example, what you would find is in the state of Florida, for example, you'd have a circumstance in which there would be approximately 80,000 more votes for Al Gore in 2000 than he actually was credited with receiving. And so that goes on in state after state throughout the South. Let's look at Georgia, for example. I think you can make the argument that if convicted felons who completed their sentences were allowed to vote in Georgia, Georgia would go to Barack Obama next week. As it stands right now, John McCain is still holding on to a slim lead. But 15% of African American men in the state of Georgia are disenfranchised because of previous felony convictions. And Georgia has a disproportionately high African American population. So it's just a tremendous story that in state after state, elections are being dictated by laws that, in my opinion, have some level of immorality to them. I mean, we're talking about, in some cases, people who have completed their sentences, completed their parole, completed their probation, and are still precluded from voting. And in no other segment that I can think of American society do we permanently remove something from somebody because of a crime. We don't even, in the case of American citizens, take away their citizenship if they are, in fact, convicted of a felony offense.
As we can see right now with the senator from Alaska, it's a whole other story to look at potential issues of racism in the courts and how disproportionate the population of African American men is in prisons and things like that. So the vote is clearly skewed when felons are not given back their right to vote after serving time and completing their sentence.
Well, if I could just add quickly to your point, I think you're absolutely right. There are 2.4 million people incarcerated in the United States. And on a per capita basis, the United States is the number one incarcerator in the world. On a per capita basis, 46% of the 2.4 million are African Americans. And African American women comprise the fastest growing segment of America's prison population. So the hyper-incarceration of African Americans is having a tremendous impact on black communities all around the country, and voting is just one segment of that impact.
Yes. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Michael Fontrai, who's a specialist in urban policy and civil rights. He's on the faculty of the George Mason School of Public Policy and speaks widely on issues of black voting rights and civil rights in this country. So let's talk about the vote today, a little bit about the issues that are coming up right now, especially throughout the primaries and a lot more right now. We hear Senator McCain and Governor Palin talk about Barack Obama as being elitist. In another breath, we hear them talk about him being socialist and some of his associations. I'm just wondering what you think of the term elitist in terms of him being the first African American nominee for president, and is that like a code word for not staying in a place that they think that?
Well, there's no question. Well, Sarah Palin is picking up on the talking points that have been provided to her by the Republican Party, I believe. And the notion that Barack Obama is an elitist, to me, is code language for saying he's uppity, which is some lexicon from a bygone era that was used to describe African Americans who were educated at some level and sought to conduct themselves in a certain way. You know, I find that description of Obama particularly curious. Did Senator McCain during the 2000 Republican primaries say that George Bush was an elitist? I mean, after all, Bush is a graduate of two Ivy League institutions, as Obama, and President Bush's father was a former president, and his grandfather was a former senator. I mean, that seems pretty elite to me. And not only that, he attended Phillips Andover Academy, which is one of the most prestigious schools in the country. So I think that the elitist thing is a tactical usage to try to generate some sort of hostility toward him in the electorate amongst those people who might be so inclined to be offended by the presence of an uppity black man.
And also a lot of what we're hearing right now refers to the Bradley effect. It's been thrown around a little bit in terms of, just in case, on the day after the election, we find that Senator McCain has won, it could be because of a difference in the polling. Let's talk a little bit about the Bradley effect and whether you think that that's really in play in this election or not.
Okay. Well, the Bradley effect is a term given to a phenomenon in polling that revealed itself in the 1980s and since, in which white voters have not been particularly honest with pollsters in describing for whom they intend to vote on Election Day. And it's named after Tom Bradley, who many people may recall as the former mayor of Los Angeles. He ran for governor of California. He was up a substantial margin in the weekend before the election, I believe double digits, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, seemingly, he lost the election. And when pollsters went back and took a look at what happened, they realized that they were just not being told the truth by some people who responded to the polls. Now, this is something that has occurred in a number of races, a number of campaign elections around the country featuring African-American nominees and white nominees. Now, in some cases, the African-American candidate will win anyway, even though they have been sort of hit by this. Doug Wilder, in his 1991 run for governor of Virginia, won. But he was up 17 points the weekend before the race and ended up winning by less than 0.1%. And so, again, this is a reflection of some of the chicanery that some voters have engaged in with pollsters. And so, is it something that can occur in this election? I think it can. I think it probably will. But I do think that if Senator Obama maintains a 10-point lead going into this weekend, he's probably inoculated by it. You know, there was a poll that came out at the end of last month that was done by AP and Yahoo News, and they conducted the poll. They commissioned Stanford University to conduct the poll. And what they found was they quantified a 6-point sort of black tax, as I call it, suggesting that Barack Obama may well lose 6 percentage points just because he's black. Now, that poll has since been called into question by other pollsters. But if, for the sake of this discussion, they have it right, and the number is, in Barack Obama's lead is 9 percentage points, and you subtract 6 from the 9, you're down to 3. So why is 3 points significant? It's still a lead, right? Well, remember, the margin of error in most polls is about 3 points. So if that 6-point number is correct, given the margin for error, it's quite possible that actually the lead is much smaller, if not an even race. Now, by all the evidence I've seen, Barack Obama is moving in the right direction, and Senator McCain is moving in the wrong direction. So I think that Senator Obama will be fine on Election Day in terms of winning this election, because I just don't see how the Republican base, which has shrunk considerably over the years, will be able to overcome this tremendous electoral wave that I think has almost as much to do with anger and hostility toward President Bush as it does with Senator Obama's own attributes, which are substantial.
Right. So largely the Bradley effect refers to racism and people not being willing to admit to their racism when they say, yes, they're going to vote for the candidate who is African-American, and then they get in the polls and they do their own thing. And that was coined about the 1982 race. So it's being claimed now that people are much more honest and overt and wouldn't lie about something like that. But do you think that the reason that Doug Wilder was successful in his race was because it was Virginia? It's a whole different state than California, different mindset about racism and politics. He was up by 17 points. So, of course, much more of a margin difference. But do you think that we've really come that far in 2008, and it's true that people would just say what they think?
Well, I think people are more honest with pollsters now because there is more attention given to this, and pollsters have put have added questions to their polls over the years that have sort of gotten to the question a bit in a bit more nuanced and sophisticated ways. So I do think the polling is, generally speaking, more accurate, but that does not mean that there isn't a latent populace out there who's still particularly unwilling to vote for an African American. Now, having said all this, you know, state races and a national presidential election are two completely different things, because in state races, the winner is the person who gets the most votes. That's not necessarily the case in a presidential election. And so what you really need to do is focus on the state-by-state polls. And all of the state-by-state polls are again, showing Senator Obama moving in the right direction and Senator McCain moving in the wrong direction.
There's actually been a fairly substantial grant by the National Science Foundation to the University of Texas, to a couple of researchers there, to study the Bradley effect in this election.
Oh, well, I'm not aware of that, but I'm happy to hear it. I'd be curious to see the results of their work. I think it's very difficult to get to the intentions of individuals when they go into the voting booth. So I'll be really curious to see how that turns out.
Right. And also an interesting thing is whether or not pollsters are calling cell phones, because in 2008, so many more people do all of their communication on cell phones than on landlines. And there's that factor in the polls as well, as far as polling accuracy.
You know, let me speak to that. I did a segment on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer a week or so ago, and was on a panel moderated by Gwen Ifill. And on the panel was Andrew Kohut from the Pew Research Center. And I asked him about it, and have spoken with other pollsters about that phenomenon recently. And I think that what we're seeing is that is being addressed. I happened just last night, for the very first time in my life, to receive a call from a pollster, from a Zogby pollster. And at the end of the poll, when they were trying to get the demographic information, one of the questions they asked was, were they reaching me on a landline or a cell phone? And so I think that Zogby and perhaps some of the other more sophisticated pollsters are weighting the polls in a way that takes into consideration mobile phone users. Now, you know, we don't know if all the pollsters are doing that, but I get the sense that the better ones are. I know that Pew is, because that's what Andy Cohen told me, and I assume that that's the case with Zogby, because they asked, and I would also suggest to you that the most serious and sophisticated and believable polls probably do take that into consideration at some level. I can't be certain that they have it weighted entirely appropriately, but I am certain that they are considering it.
Well, that's a very good point. And there's actually information on the internet now about polls and their accuracy and the margin of error, and it's as complete as anything is on the internet these days that you can Google. So let's talk a little bit about some of the other tickets that are not heard as much, such as Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente of the Green Party. Cynthia McKinney, of course, the former representative in Georgia. What would you say the influence is there in the African-American community and perhaps allegiance to the vote there?
Let me preface my comments first by saying, just sort of as a political scientist and somebody who's interested in the best possible politics for the country, it is unfortunate that our so-called third parties are not getting the attention they are, that they should in the electorate. That's very unfortunate. And I think that Cynthia McKinney, for example, is one person sort of hurt by that. The reality is all of the attention is going to the Democrats and the Republicans, and all of the other so-called third parties are not getting the attention that they need. I think in terms of what's going on with the African-American community, I think any impact that a McKinney candidacy could have on the black community is muted, if not made moot, by the presence of Barack Obama at the head of the Democratic ticket. I think that his presence has really coalesced the African-American community, even among Republicans. I've had the occasion to make some acquaintances with Republicans as I was researching my most recent book, Republicans and the Black Vote, and I will tell you there are a number of them who are frustrated with the Republican Party, and have been for years with regard to its unwillingness to conduct serious outreach to African Americans. And as a result of that frustration, coupled with the magnetic candidacy of Barack Obama, I believe there are a number of African American Republicans that will support Obama. And so if that's the case with African American Republicans supporting Obama, I think it'd be very difficult, unfortunately, for former Representative McKinney to get any traction. And again, given how our presidential election works, it's just really unfortunate the way the so-called third parties are treated.
So you don't think it's going to hurt the Democratic Party?
No, this election, I think Democratic voters in particular have their eyes on the ball, if you will, in terms of being focused on the electorate. I think a very strong argument can be made that Ralph Nader's presence in 2000 hurt Al Gore in Virginia and kept him from winning, West Virginia, and kept him from winning that state and ultimately the presidency. And I think that Democratic voters are much more understanding of that kind of alternative candidacy, and as a result, I just do not see these parties getting much traction right now in the electorate. That's unfortunate. I think that for the so-called third parties to really make a difference, they're going to have to find some state legislative seats and some U.S. congressional seats, representative seats, that they can target and build grassroots support in very targeted portions of the country, and then try to win some seats and move from there.
Do you think that the Democratic Party in general and Senator Obama in particular is bringing out the black vote much more than before? What are you seeing in terms of the mobilization and enthusiasm?
Well, I think the enthusiasm is just incredible. I can't tell you how many times I have heard people talking about politics that I never knew even thought much about politics, let alone talk about it, contribute money, go out and canvass for candidates and such. You know, I live in Washington, D.C., and Northern Virginia has been a particularly interesting place to observe during this campaign season, because the state is turning blue on the strength of what's going on in Northern Virginia. The suburbs of Washington, D.C., there's a Republican representative, Tom Davis, who's retiring from his seat, and now that seat is up for grabs, and a Democrat is favored to win it. And so, you know, the sense I'm getting is that people are extremely excited about what's going on and are acting accordingly.
I want to read something from your book. And again, we're speaking with Michael Fauntroy, author of Republicans and the Black Vote. Now, toward the end of your book, you say something about the problem facing Republicans is that most black leaders are overtly black in their terms of policy advocacy. And you go on to talk about how African Americans live with the reality of race every day, and their leaders and their organizational affiliations should be concerned about their welfare. Republicans, particularly conservative Republicans, want to act as if race no longer plays a role in the lives of African Americans or the larger society, and therefore want to ignore it completely. So I think this is a very important point, especially in some of the smear campaigns that are happening now, where we hear there have been phone calls that talk about if Senator Obama wins the race for the president, about all the changes that will take place. There's a threat to Jewish voters that will experience another Holocaust. What would you say about the claims that of the smear campaigns, and also particularly about the overtly black public policy that you talk about, and how that differs from what the Republican campaign is threatening?
Well, I think these tactics are, of course, reprehensible, but also not a surprise. You know, Jody, the reality is the Republican Party has won an awful lot of elections at the national and state levels around this country on the strength of racial demagoguery and religious demagoguery. It's just the way things have been, and so I'm not surprised by that. The robocalls, the leaflets that have no claim of responsibility attached, and so on, is part of a long history of the Republican Party in this regard. So I think that the Republicans, this is the last election in which the Republicans will be able to win with that kind of tactic. I think that the country, for economic reasons, is moving away from that kind of stuff. And so I just think that the party itself is going to have to figure out a way to reform itself in an effort to be more inclusive. As you know, the country is becoming much more racially diverse. And according to the U.S. Census Bureau, by 2042, there will be no majority race in the United States. And so, to my way of thinking, the Republicans are going to have to come to grips with that reality, or face continued marginalization and becoming a regional party, because in your part of the country and in my part of the country, North, I don't think people are going to respond to that in the same way, or in enough of a way for Republicans to win elections.
Yeah, they are saying that Caucasians are no longer going to be the majority, I think, as of next year in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Senator Obama was accused of, at one point, not being black enough, and then at another point, being too black. Let's talk about what that means as well. What does not black enough mean?
Well, that gets back to the point that you made in quoting from the book. Senator Obama has been criticized as not being black enough, in part because of his willingness to accept the sort of overtly black political public policy approaches that many African-American politicians have sought. And by that I'm talking about sort of race-specific public policy issues. You know, the reality is African-Americans, like many different segments of the American population, have unique public policy needs, no different than Jewish voters or environmental voters or anti-abortion voters and so on and so forth. And African Americans want to see that those issues are addressed. And to this point, Barack Obama has not shown much of that. Now, alternatively, though, for some people, being any kind of black is being too black, which gets to the other side, which speaks to the other side of what you just identified, in which by simply being a black candidate, that black candidate is too much for some people to take.
And yet we have images in Hollywood of Morgan Freeman playing the president very well in a very calm and stately manner. So it's interesting that...
Dennis Haysbert on 24.
Uh-huh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Well, imagery is important, and I think that imagery... you can't underestimate the impact of pop culture that helped change people's views. You know, I think, and I'm dating myself a bit here, but you know, you may remember the Cosby Show back in the mid-80s and into the early 90s. I think that show did an awful lot to change people's views of African-American professionals and open the eyes of some people in that regard. And so, yes, I think a President Obama would go a long way toward opening the eyes of some people with regard to African Americans.
Absolutely. To have seen back then a doctor, African American doctor on TV in a healthy family situation.
And married in a loving marriage to an African American lawyer.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, really opened people's minds.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I think we've just about covered everything. If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Michael Fauntroy from the George Mason School of Public Policy, and you speak widely on issues of civil rights and the black vote. And your current book, Republicans and the Black Vote, published by Lynn Reiner Publishers.
Yeah, out of Boulder.
Yeah.
Few hours from you by air.
Very extensive reading on the history of the black vote in America and coming to where we are now. Would you like to share any other thoughts about the upcoming election and anything else regarding?
Sure. Actually, there are a couple points that I'd like to share. One of which is, African American voters are very energized by this race. And what you see in early voting patterns in states that allow for early voting is that African Americans in the states in which there is early voting have been participating early at a much higher and disproportionately high rate than in previous years. And so I think that Senator Obama is going to win, say, 94-95% of the black vote. But what's going to be significant about that is that he's going to win that of a much larger pie. Now, Al Gore won 91% of the black vote in 2000. So it's not unusual for a Democratic nominee to win such an overwhelming proportion of the vote. But again, given the size, the growth of African-American voters through registration efforts by a number of organizations, not just the Democratic Party, I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens in some of these southern states that have significant black populations. For example, if you look at some of these electoral maps, Georgia, a state I mentioned earlier, and Mississippi are not rated as deep red this go-round. They're seen at some level as just barely Republican, and that is a function of the disproportionately high black voting population in those two states. Mississippi's black voting population is about a third of the elect, and so and the overwhelming majority of them will turn out for Barack Obama. And so I think what you want to also look for early, you know, for those of you in Northern California who are watching the results, you know, when 8 o'clock comes in, and most of those polls are closing in Georgia and in Mississippi, you'll want to see how close those states are. If one of those two states goes for Obama, then to my way of thinking, the election is over, because if he's winning Georgia or Mississippi, then he's going to clean up as the clock goes west. And so I think that your listeners should be mindful of that. Another state you want to look out for is Virginia. In Virginia, North Carolina, if those two states, which have been trending toward the Democrats over the course of the last decade or so, if those states go for Obama, again, it's going to be over very early. Virginia and North Carolina are very interesting because those states have greatly moderated because of the influx of and the impact of higher education in those states. The Research Triangle in North Carolina of Durham, Chapel Hill, and Raleigh, which is where Duke University, the University of North Carolina, and North Carolina State respectively are located, has been a magnet for tech workers. And the same thing can be said in Northern Virginia, as George Mason University, my university, has grown, and now it's nearly the largest public university in the state. You have a tremendous influx of tech workers because the Northern Virginia Dulles Airport corridor has really grown in recent years in terms of tech companies and government contractors. Well, the people who have been coming in to take jobs in those sectors aren't driven by the same racial politics that longstanding Virginians or North Carolinians are. And so I think those two states are going to be very interesting to watch as well.
Part of the problem out here in California is I think people see what's happening in the polls on the East Coast and could possibly become apathetic or feel like, well, my vote doesn't matter anymore because it's 3 hours later by the time they start counting California votes. However, I want to put in a plug for early voting. It's possible. Just get your vote in, walk it down, mail it in, etc. That's one of the issues out here.
Yeah, I agree, and I think complacency is a problem even on the East Coast. You know, there are a number of people, I believe, who are going to just assume that Barack Obama has it locked up and won't turn out, and they could end up being in for a big surprise. You know, the issue of Californians and Oregonians and Washingtonians, and for that matter, and others out in your part of the country, you know, sort of feeling that their vote may not matter, is yet another argument for the abolition of the Electoral College. I think that the winner of the most votes should be the president, without regard to an Electoral College, which, to my way of thinking, is an elite edifice designed to keep a wall, a barrier between the people and the government.
Well, wouldn't that be a real democracy if every vote counted?
Yeah, wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, and also we've been hearing about issues in Colorado with, again, voter disenfranchisement, and the article that appeared in Rolling Stone magazine about that could potentially dissuade some people from voting if they feel like, oh, it's already stolen or there's already complications, why bother? However,
well, you know, you mentioned Colorado, and I have to tell you, Colorado is the state that I'm worried about. Here's why. You know, in 2004, President Bush, the Bush campaign was able to hold on because of state ballot initiatives that were placed on state ballot questions that were placed on the elections, statewide elections in Ohio and a handful of other really close states, that were asking questions about abortion and affirmative action and gay marriage. And those issues drove conservative voters to the polls, and so they went to vote against these issues and for President Bush. Well, in Colorado, they have 18 ballot initiatives next week, and among them are affirmative action, abortion, and one that really worries me, and this is one that will deals with the issue of mandatory union membership and a mandatory dues payment. And so they're hoping that with the Republican Party is hoping that with the with these questions being on the ballot, that perhaps the state could still be in play for Senator McCain.
Especially with a nasty phone calling campaign that might happen the night before.
Oh, without doubt.
Voting, as I think we saw in Oregon in 2004. Well, vote early. Vote. Vote your conscience. And I want to thank you so much, Michael Fauntroy, for being my guest today. And Michael Fauntroy's book, Republicans and the Black Vote. Very interesting reading. And I very much appreciate your time, sir, and all of your knowledge. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can live in a mansion. You can live in